Thomas E. Kennedy, a native New Yorker living in Denmark, wrote for years before the publication of his first book in 1988. That's when his fiction and essays began appearing regularly in New Letters magazine. 20 years later, Kennedy's essay, I Am Joe's Prostate, won the 2008 National Magazine Award for New Letters, beating out finalists from The New Yorker, Harper's, and The Atlantic Monthly.
I just would not have expected that this single award would really make such a difference.
After winning the Epi, Kennedy's earlier works, including his four novels that make up his Copenhagen Quartet, were published in the U.S. He has continued to write stories and essays for New Letters magazine, and his most recent one is part of our summer subscription special at newletters.org. So we'll revisit his 2008 interview, in which he shares his approach to essay writing and reads from his book, Riding the Dog, a look back at America on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and here's Thomas E. Kennedy.
All of the craft that goes into fiction also goes into this kind of personal essay. So you're using sensory evocation, you're deliberately choosing your verbs to try and get the most strength out of your sentences and paying attention to your sentence rhythms, and you actually have to create characters, which sounds odd, because you think, well, it's nonfiction. You know, why do you have to create characters? Because people are just there. But people are many different things. I am many different things. So I have to create a character of myself, even though I'm the narrator often. And when you think of your own self, of your own character, some days one is gloomy. Some days one is happy. Some days one is quick. Some days one is slow, etc. You sort of have to select the mask for your character and for all of your characters. A mask is, well, this whole idea of persona, which means per sonare, the mask that the actors in the ancient theater sounded through. And really, you have to select the mask for each of the characters. And I think the way to do that is really by careful observation in the specific situation.
And that's what you do, I think, very deftly in your book of essays. I got to hear your talk at the Kansas City Public Library, and someone asked, did you keep a notebook? And you
Yes.
said you always carry paper and a pen with you.
Yes.
So I wondered, when you're gathering these thoughts, because you might overhear something, and in fact, I'm going to have you read a passage from your new book, Riding the Dog, where you do overhear a little something. If you write all this stuff down, then what do you do with it? Do you go back later and read over your notes? I mean, how do you catalog it? How do you use it? Or just the act of writing it down, does that make it stick in your memory?
Actually, just the act very rarely makes it stick in my memory. In fact, I have notes all over the place. And sometimes I read them and I think, wow, did I actually experience this? You know? So it's very important for me to write things down. And I always carry an 8.5 by 11 inch piece of paper, and I fold it in four, and I tear it into little squares, and I sort of flap one page over it, and I carry it in my back pocket. This is my current method and has been my method for about 5 years. You know, you hear such wonderful things all the time, and if you don't write them down, they're lost. And it's just the same as thoughts are fleeting through your head all the time. And I think one of the jobs of a writer is to stop that thought, to make it stop and observe it and write it down, which is what James Joyce does in Ulysses so magnificently. You know, otherwise the thought just travels through your head and is gone, and that's it. So I do take notes, and usually if I don't use the notes within a certain amount of time, you know, it's almost like they have a use before date.
They expires on.
Exactly. They sort of get transferred from my desk to a shoebox. And then when the shoebox is full, it goes up on a top shelf in the bookcase. But the thing about writing all these things down, it sort of elongates or expands the whole process of writing, because you've got all these little gems, these little snatches of conversation, observations that you yourself make, the weather, a slant of sunlight, a turn of phrase that occurs to you or that you hear somewhere, the ironic expression on someone's face. So you've got all these things jotted down. And when you're writing, people talk about writing as though you start with page one and you finish with page 300 or page 20 or whatever, and, you know, you produce this linear product. But my process is not that way at all. By the time I write an essay, it sort of exists already. I just don't know exactly how it's going to fit together. So the final part of the process is the cohesion of these little bits and of filling in the blank spaces between them.
You've done a lot of the writing in your head, basically.
Yes.
Okay.
But not so methodically, because I find that if I know exactly what's going to happen, then it's not going to happen, you know.
Yeah, because you lose that wonderment, that act of discovery that hopefully happens for you as a writer and for the reader as well.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. I'm talking to Thomas Kennedy, and this is New Letters on the Air. I'm Angela Elam. Let me have you read a little bit from the title essay in the book Riding the Dog, and the dog refers to the Greyhound bus.
Yes.
I almost feel like these essays are travel writing because we're traveling in parts of America and finally in Denmark, the country that you've lived in for half of your life now.
Yes.
But we get a sense of the place. We also get a sense of the history and the characters who inhabit the place at the moment that you are there. And I just love that about what you do in this set of essays. So I thought we get you to start with the middle of this essay, Riding the Dog.
Okay. The elegant Art Deco facade of the Greyhound Terminal at 109 Martin Luther King Boulevard in Savannah speaks of the 40s when bus travel was still mainstream. I think of Steinbeck's Wayward Bus and Marilyn Monroe in Bus Stop. Inside, the terminal is shabby. Where once would have been a Good American diner is now a Wendy's. And we learn that our connection is delayed by 45 minutes. At the chilly doorway, a shirtless, leanly muscular white man with two missing front teeth and neo-Celtic tattoos up and down his arms and chest tells us with a grin that his bus to Jackson has been delayed for 12 hours. He tugs up his jogging pants and nods jauntily at me and Marvin, as if to say, "Now that's a delay." A black driver in gray uniform looks at the man's ticket. "This here's for Jackson, North Carolina. You ticketed to Jackson, Ohio." says the man with his imperturbable grin, and hitches up his joggers. I wonder if he is just proud of his torso or doesn't own a shirt. Maybe he gave someone the shirt off his back. Preposterous as it may seem from his appearance, he has an aura, strikes me as someone who a century and a half before in Russia might have qualified for canonization by Fyodor Dostoevsky. In the Wendy's, I buy a container of coffee and cheeseburger and greasy paper and watch a couple and two children sit down to their bags of junk food, bow their heads in grace. Marvin asks if I will watch his shoebox and paper bag while he goes to buy a can of orange soda from a vending machine. A warning printed on the side of my paper cup of coffee advises me that it is hot. I am excited about the stop in Savannah, where I've never been before. One of the most beautiful cities in North America, where an 11-year-old Conrad Aiken, author of one of my favorite stories, Silent Snow, Secret Snow, listened from the next room while his father, the doctor, shot his mother, then himself. Birthplace of Johnny Mercer, grandson of a Confederate general, who wrote one of my favorite songs, The Summer Wind. Where Flannery O'Connor grew up in a house on Lafayette Square, where Charles Wesley wrote Hark the Herald Angels Sing, where Juliet Gordon Lowe founded the Girl Scouts of America in 1913, where all the alluring exaggerations of John Berendt's Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil unfold, where Martin Luther King first delivered his I Have a Dream sermon at the Second African Baptist Church on Green Square. But our stop there is too brief for sightseeing, and it is too dark now to see anything on the road, so I lean back and half doze, half eavesdrop, on a conversation somewhere behind me. One man is telling another he just did 4 months for a DUI. Third time. Wouldn't let me pay no fine. I tell you, I ain't going back to that bullshit. Third time. Ain't going back to that bullshit. Wouldn't happen to a white boy.
That's a little bit from riding the dog. And Marvin, one of the characters that you met along the way, is a young 23-year-old black man who's just been released from prison and is going home to see his two small children. But I want to skip over to the end, to Beaufort.
Okay. At Beaufort's tiny Greyhound terminal, two women and two girls are waiting to greet Marvin, who has donned a white stocking cap for the occasion. His step is light as he swaggers into their embrace, a fine-looking family. Their battered Ford is parked out back in the little lot. I stand at the door looking for my hosts, and Marvin turns back to me. He places the palms of his hands together and bows his head. "Thank you for your kindness, sir," he says. "Thank you." I wish him luck and watch them pile into the car and back out. Their power steering needs fluid, I think, and watch as the car squeals and turns out of the lot, putters off into the darkness. A few moments later, a black Mercedes SUV pulls in, and my friends Rick and Ricky hop out with friendly exclamations of welcome. With a gentle, incredulous smile, Rick says, "You took the bus? I haven't been on a bus since I was 20. "I've never been on a bus," Ricky says, laughing. "Why the hell didn't you rent a car?" Rick says. "You could have been here in half the time, less." I smile and climb into the redolent black leather seat of the Mercedes and listen to the silken purr of the motor as we back out through the dust of the lot, headed for the gated community of Hilton Head. A few blocks up, we stop for a light alongside Marvin's family Ford. I see his white stocking cap at the window of the back seat. He does not recognize me.
That's just a portion of the title essay from the book Riding the Dog, A Look Back at America by Thomas Kennedy. And I should also say that that essay was originally published in New Letters magazine as well.
It was, yes.
I love the juxtaposition that you did at the end there with your friends picking you up in that fancy car and then Marvin driving off in his car that needs help. And then seeing him later and he doesn't recognize you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really good. It takes a while for Marvin to trust you, we should say, in the beginning of this essay.
He absolutely wants nothing to do with me in the beginning. You know, I'm wearing a Stetson hat and smoking a cigar, and I must look like a cop, you know, or a sheriff or something.
That gives us an idea because you're eavesdropping on the conversation of the not-so-pleasant guy earlier. And so I'm wondering, when you're thinking about writing this essay, and you've already kind of formulated it in your mind, do you then go back to your notes that you've gathered on this trip through the South, let's say, and review them?
That's quite exactly what I do. I sort of have the notes in process. I write everything by hand first, the first draft.
Now, why do you do that?
I like the tactility of it, and I have a pen that I love. I have a Mont Blanc pen, which I've written my last 7 or 8 books with. And it just sits so nicely in my hand, and I love lined paper. And I like to sit in an easy chair with my legs crossed. And I have a big painting by a Danish artist of a face, which has a green nose and two different colored eyes and sort of gray teeth. And this face is sort of looking out incredulously at the world. And when I'm writing, every so often I glance up at the face to see if he approves of what I'm doing. If he seems to be scowling, I look more closely at what I'm writing. But anyway, I do take the notes, and often the notes will include something that is an opening paragraph, for example. Or, for example, that essay begins with a detail of Marvin boarding the bus with all of his possessions in a shoebox and a paper bag. When I got on that bus and saw this fellow, I think I sort of knew that this guy was going to be written about. And when I heard him say to this very friendly African-American woman on the bus that he just got out of jail where he's, you know, he's 23 years old and he has been in jail since he was 16. And when I heard that, I wanted to know something about this. So I was anxious to talk to the fellow, but I didn't want to scare him off. And fortunately for me, this lovely African-American woman, who was just a beautiful person, she sort of mediated between me and Marvin and got us sort of hooked up a little, even though he still didn't trust me. And then she sort of disappeared in North Augusta. So anyway, jotting down all these notes, for example, I have a list in there of places that we're passing. If I didn't write them down, I would never remember it. You know, all these different churches, Econo Lodge, and, you know, I can't even remember them now, but because I jotted them down, I'm able to create this impression of looking out of a bus window and seeing these things sort of fleet past, as happens when you're on a bus. But usually they just go in one ear and out the other. So, you know, if I don't write them down, I don't have them there to use.
Yeah. And what's nice about it, too, is that I'm from Georgia, but there was a lot of stuff in there that you had about the history of Savannah that I didn't know. But that's what's so wonderful, that an essay can draw you into the personal situation, but also make you aware of the wider world.
I think that's important, too. Just as Melville had all those chapters about the techniques of whaling and the technical facts, I really like to put in a lot of facts when I'm writing a personal essay, because when you know the history of a place, it becomes much more vibrant and vital to you. I lived in Copenhagen for 20 years, from 1976 to 1996. And then one day in 1996, I suddenly realized that I always walked on the same streets. I knew virtually nothing, but I knew very little about Denmark. I knew not much about Danish history. So I decided that I am going to come now to understand Denmark, Copenhagen. In the process of doing that, you know, I invested in a lot of books on Danish street sculpture, on Danish history, on Danish literature, and also began to read more Danish novels and Danish poetry. Someone gave me a book of Danish serving houses. It happens that there are 1,525 serving houses in Copenhagen.
Is a serving house a...
It's a fancy name for a bar.
For a bar.
It sounds so elegant. You know?
It does, a serving house.
Then I got this idea, you know, as all these facts were coming clear to me, I got this idea of writing a novel disguised as a guide to the serving houses of Copenhagen, where each chapter would take place in a different serving house. And what I wanted to do was, I had fallen in love with Copenhagen all over again because I was learning all these wonderful things about it. For example, there's a square there called the Kohl Square, where there is a little serving house called the White Lamb. I had seen that serving house so many times and just never went in because I thought something in my mind sort of sensed it, said, ooh, not a nice place, don't go in there, you know. And then I started to look at it, and I saw that it has been there since 1807. And I learned that Søren Kierkegaard used to live in the apartment right across the street from it.
Oh, wow.
And I learned that the Duke of Wellington in 1807, the same year the bar was opened, had shelled Copenhagen and blown the roof off this bar. And then I thought to myself, how great that the Duke of Wellington is dead, but this bar is still here, you know. Because that was quite a brutal thing he did. He killed 1,700 civilians, actually, at a time when the population of Copenhagen was not very high. But anyway, the thing is that I wanted all of this information somehow to get into the novel without making it an information dump. And that was my challenge in writing that. The fiction part of it sort of took care of itself. That story just developed very naturally, and it was kind of a strange story. But I didn't really pay attention to it. What I was paying attention to was the factual history and the sculpture that's on the streets in Copenhagen and in the parks and the lakes and everything else. That novel is called Kerrigan's Copenhagen. It's the first of four novels I wrote about Copenhagen. And people often say to me, well, that's just autobiography, isn't it? And I say, no, it's a novel. But I think the reason why they really are convinced that it's autobiography is simply because there are so many facts in it.
Yeah, because that makes it even more real.
Yeah, yeah. I think it does. Yeah.
Speaking of that quartet of novels that you've written, you've been likened to doing for Copenhagen what the great master did for Dublin, the James Joyce of Copenhagen. How do you feel about that comparison?
Well, I think the word hyperbole comes to mind. But, you know, it was nice of that fellow to say that.
Yeah, who said that? Where did I read that?
It's the editor of Frank magazine in Paris, David Applefield. He published an interview with me once. And in fact, that interview resulted in that novel getting published and the following three novels, because an Irish publisher read that interview, which was in a magazine published in France, but he happened to read it and he contacted me and asked to see the novel and then published it and then published my next three novels, which was a wonderful thing for me as a writer, because once I knew that the novels were going to be published, in some way it released more energy in me. You know, you always have this thing, or maybe not all writers, but I always have this thing in my head that, gee, I wonder if this thing's ever going to get published that I'm working on. And when you invest in a novel, you might be investing up to 2, 3, even 4 years. But when you know in advance that it's almost positive that it is going to get published and where it's going to get published and that it's going to be published in a nice edition, you can release all of that worry energy on the prose, which is why I think that the best two novels that I've ever written are the third and fourth of those Copenhagen novels. And I think it is simply because, you know, I was not worried about where my next publication was going to come from.
The Copenhagen novels, you are fluent in Danish.
Yes, I have a bad accent, but I'm fluent.
But you wrote that in English. Have they been translated into Danish too?
They haven't, but my new agent, who I have as a result of the New Letters Award, he was amazed that they haven't been published in Scandinavian languages. And he has a counterpart in Stockholm, so he's going to try and sell them for translation now. I would love that, because Danes are very, very good at English, and they do read them, and the books are reviewed in the Danish papers. You know, the English versions of them are reviewed. But people still ask me, you know, oh, I really enjoyed that. Do you write anything in Danish? So I would love it if they were translated into Danish, because, you know, Denmark is my adopted home now.
So. Yeah, and now you're going on that slope where you've actually been there more than you've been living in the United States.
That's right. It's exactly half and half at
half
the moment.
And half.
So next year it will be, you know, one more year in Denmark.
Well, I want to go back to riding the dog for a moment, because the title essay begins with Marvin. You end the essay with Marvin. He's this 23-year-old. It's kind of a nice springboard into the next essays, because you're looking back at your life when you're in your 20s, you know, and traveling, dealing with your father's death.
Yes.
He died when you were 20 years old. And a lot of that has to do with New York. It's, in essence, a tribute to your father. And I thought I would get you to read just a little passage that would give people an idea of who your father is.
Sure, I'd love to.
It's right in the middle of the bridge back to Queens. I'm talking to Thomas Kennedy, and he's about to read from the book Riding the Dog, A Look Back at America.
I ride the L from 82nd Street back towards Manhattan, but when the train slides into the Queensboro Plaza station, I get off, climb down the staircase to the road and traffic-snarled plaza where my father worked for 38 years behind the polished brass doors of what is now Astoria Federal Savings Bank. This building had been taken over in 1920 as the headquarters of the Long Island City Savings Bank, established 1870. My father started working there in 1925 when he was 19, when his own father died, skipping college to earn a living while his older sister went to Vassar. Here, behind these tall, polished doors, he spent the bulk of his adult life. I still have the engraved 18-karat gold Hamilton watch with which he was presented in 1950 for a quarter century's service. 14 years later, I would come home from an afternoon at the beach to find the living room of our home spattered with blood. My mother would tell me later that he had suddenly spouted blood like a fountain. I hurried over to Elmhurst Hospital, where he was dying of a sudden internal bleeding whose source the doctors could not locate or close. 3 days later, he was dead. In that hospital complex that rose from the field where he used to take me to the carnival a decade before, where we used to watch baseball games, 58 years old, no age at all, dead of drink and broken dreams. He so wanted to be a poet. He was a poet.
That's from the essay, The Bridge Back to Queens. Included in the collection of essays, Riding the Dog, A Look Back at America. I'm talking to Thomas Kennedy, and this is New Letters on the Air. Your father is woven into these essays, much in the way that you weave the facts in and out. And we see him from different vantage points in a couple of the different essays. And I couldn't help but think, oh, if he could see you now, it would be so wonderful. In some ways, you fulfilled his dream. You must feel that somewhat.
Well, he actually encouraged me very much. I decided I wanted to be a writer when I was 17 years old.
So he knew that you wanted to go on that path.
And he read the first few things I wrote, my first, you know, fledgling efforts, and it was very, very encouraging. I remember overhearing him say to my oldest brother once, "That boy's got it." And that was very encouraging to me because, you know, my father, although he was a banker, he was very involved with literature. He was always reading. We had lots of books in the house, and he read to us, and he was a great reader. And my mother was actually a great reader also. She had stopped reading because she said it distracted her from the things she had to do. But occasionally we would get her to read a poem aloud, and she just had a beautiful reading voice and a beautiful expressive way of reading poetry. You know, I really feel that my father started me off. And he also actually, if I can backtrack to when I was 15, my love of literature actually came from one day I was up in my room and I was bored and felt like something was missing. And I thought, well, maybe I should try to read something. So I went down and my father was sitting in the living room in his chair reading. And I asked him, you know, "Do you have a book that you think it would be good for me to read?" And he thought for a minute, and then he went to one of his shelves and he took out a book called Crime and Punishment by Fyodor Dostoevsky. And I looked and I thought, what a weird book this is to give me, you know, what is this about, about the Russian justice system, or what is this? But I brought it up to my room and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And I opened it and started to read, and I was hooked instantly. And reading began to become a very, very important thing for me, and I was constantly reading books. I wish I could read with that energy today as I did then, because I was reading like 5 books a week. I went through all of Dostoevsky, and then I started with Steinbeck and so on and so forth. I always date my love of literature and my wish to be a writer, although I didn't yet know it, to that day when I was 15 that my father handed me that book. I still have that book, in fact, and his signature is on the flyleaf, so I really, really cherish that book.
Yeah. Well, Tom, I feel like I could sit here and talk to you, the James Joyce of Copenhagen.
Keep that hyperbole alive.
If you'd like to hear more about Thomas E. Kennedy's National Magazine Award-winning essay, I Am Joe's Prostate, go to newletters.org and click On the Air. Then look for the web extra under his name. His newest and maybe last essay, The Memory Clinic, is part of our summer subscription giveaway. Find out more about that under news at newletters.org or call us toll-free 888-548-2477. That's 888 Lit Airs. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC. Today's show was originally produced with Danette Alexander, John Hawken, and Dennis Conroe. Thanks also to Nick Shea and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.